Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening. We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment manager whose purpose is to provide excellent investment performance through active decision-making. For more than two centuries, Schroders has evolved their understanding of markets, offering investment solutions across fixed income, equities, multi-asset, as well as private markets through Schroders Capital. Schroders actively invests in companies with responsible and durable business models. They're also a leading specialist in impact investing for clients who want to maximize positive change. Capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is a British company based in Henley that was established 20 years ago by two young brothers whose dream was to design and engineer beautiful chronometers. When Giles English, one of those brothers, appeared as a guest on the Money Maze podcast last year, he brought to life the wonderful history of British watchmaking, helping to explain why the world sets its time by Greenwich Mean Time, and he captured the incredible challenge of mastering the complexities involved in making exquisitely engineered timepieces. He has said, "Never judge one of our watches until you've held it in your hand and felt the quality." And both Will Campion and I have bought a watch, and we love them. Great innovation, a tangible love for their mission, resulting in beautiful, world-class luxury wristwatches. The nucleus of top private equity firms, some of whom we're examining in this Money Maze podcast series, may not be immediately easy to differentiate, in the same way the activities of Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and JP Morgan overlap and compete. But each of these firms, although youthful, has their heritage, their variations in approach and specializations. Today's firm does, however, have an unusual genesis, for in 1984, former partners of the management consultancy firm Bain & Company founded Bain Capital as a private partnership focused on applying management consulting strategy to private equity investing. So to understand their business better, it's great today to be able to talk to Bain Capital's co-managing partner, Jonathan Levine. Today, Bain Capital is one of the world's largest private multi-asset investing firms, employee-owned and with $160 billion in assets under management. From Boston and from a rainy London, welcome Jonathan Levine to the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
In today's conversation, I hope we're going to explore Bain Capital's investment approach, dig down into the world of private credit, which we haven't discussed much on the Money Maze podcast, hear why you believe investing is not a game of predictions, and scrutinize your view of the importance of pricing risk versus understanding uncertainty, and possibly quite a lot more. But let's just start with your youth. You're on record talking about the value of a non-traditional, i.e. a non-business or finance degree, for investing, the value of it for investing. And I just wonder why you believe that.
I did not set out in college thinking that I would go to work on Wall Street and then become a consultant and ultimately work at a private investment firm that uses those skills. I went to college to learn how to think. I majored in political science and concentrated in English literature. I didn't realize it until years later that they prepared me perfectly for the job I had, because political science teaches you to think about game theory. English literature makes you think about pattern recognition. And it is actually those two things that come into my day-to-day more than thinking about advanced econometric models or things like that. Obviously, there's a huge technical aspect to our jobs, but at your core, you should understand the game theory of what you're doing. recognize the patterns. Investing has patterns associated with it. Where have I seen this before? What have the outcomes been? And then see how to apply the vast toolkit of analytical skills and tools that we have to make investments and help improve companies.
I don't want to take a detour earlier on the podcast, but I studied economic history and I managed to do a quarter of my degree in English literature, but I never felt or understood that there was pattern recognition in literature. So just tell me why.
When you are reading novels through history and certain times in literary genres, you're learning to recognize symbolism, foreshadowing, images from the past throughout literature. The old saying is history doesn't repeat itself, but rhymes. It's the concept of close reading. And whether you're reading a novel closely, reading a Shakespeare play closely, or whether you're reading a situation in life closely, it's the same skills of observation and thinking about where have I seen this before.
Great. I understand that. I might be thinking a little differently when I pick up the next novel I need to read. But tell me, what was your first ever job?
My first ever job was serving free lunches in the public parks in Providence, Rhode Island, where I grew up. During the summer, the schools were not open, so did not provide free lunches for students on free lunches. And I worked in the city park, provided substitutes for that. After that, I worked in a warehouse one summer and honestly had never set foot into a bank or a financial services firm until I interviewed coming out of college, senior year.
That sounds a bit like my first job at Bristol Zoo. But you, however, have your first proper job at Drexel's, I believe. So tell me, how did that happen? And what were the contours of that particular decision?
Having studied political science and English literature, obviously, I thought I was going to law school because everyone around me was going to law school. I had applied to law school and was admitted and, in fact, thought I was going to continue at Columbia and go to Columbia Law School. A friend of mine said these Wall Street banks have analyst programs now. And, quote, you don't need to know anything. They're just looking for smart people who will work hard. I said, I'll give it a shot and maybe I can go earn. I think they were paying $35,000 a year at the time. And I said, I'll be able to pay for law school. So I deferred law school, got a bunch of offers and went to Drexel because Drexel felt right to me. It felt entrepreneurial. It was small relative to the other firms. I didn't think I was going to make a career in finance. It actually served me incredibly well having gone there. I said, well, if I thought I was going to be a banker for the rest of my life, maybe I'd go to one of the more established firms. I went there. It was an extraordinary experience. I met some extraordinary people, many of whom I still speak to today. Applied to Harvard Business School as my analyst program was ending because having seen what lawyers do and having discovered I had an aptitude in the financial world, I said, I might as well see if I can go to business school. I was admitted to HBS about a month before Drexel went out of business. The decision was made quite easy for me. I went and serendipitously met my wife the third day of school. 32 years later, that's going strong.
Terrific. Now, does that mean post-Harvard you jump into Bain?
No. So my wife and I decided we wanted to stay in Boston. At the time, there were not a lot of financial firms in Boston hiring straight out of business school. I got a job as a summer associate in McKinsey's Boston office, really enjoyed it, was able to actually work there part-time my second year, and went to McKinsey straight out of school. A little bit less than a year later, I got a call from a small investment firm that was raising its first institutional fund. They were managing at the time about $120 million, and were going to try to get institutions so that they could raise a bigger fund of about $300 million. I went and interviewed with all the partners on a Friday, came in on a Monday, interviewed with Mitt Romney. He made me an offer. By the end of the week, I was working at Bain Capital. So it was a pretty unusual and fortuitous turn in my career. Many of my McKinsey colleagues at the time thought I had lost my mind going to the small firm coming out of a recession in investments in Boston, not going to New York. It obviously turned out great.
Let's then get into Bain Capital. I guess that as I was getting to understand your business, not having really known very much about it other than the name, one of the first things that struck me is in the public equity markets where I've spent a lot of my life, we talk about investment philosophy a lot. But maybe you could just start by articulating Bain Capital's investment philosophy.
Our investment philosophy is and has been since we started a little bit different than a number of our peer institutions. I'm sure everybody says that. We're all differentiated. Mm-hmm. But we start with an entirely different structure to the firm. We're a private partnership owned by the partners. We are the largest investors in everything we do. So our money leads. When you are investing with us, we don't do a dollar with your money that we aren't doing with our own money on every single thing we do. We approach things from very much a strategic perspective, looking at the strategic positioning of industries and of companies. I always say we don't make trades, we make investments. We are not afraid to approach opportunities where we have to do a lot of work, where we can undertake transformational change with our portfolio group, working in partnership with management teams. We're also willing to take that consulting-oriented strategic positioning perspective that was the basis for our private equity business, and we've been able to translate it to other asset classes, most notably credit, special situations. We also have a life sciences business, a social impact business, a public equity business, a technology business, a real estate business, and all of them take this strategic top-down view coupled with a bottom-up concept of business or asset transformation.
You did something that's important. You did not use that word that always causes me to come back. You did not use that word unique, which is the most overused word in the English and commercial language. So well done for that. Following on from that, could you talk a little bit about Bain Capital's track record?
We obviously have had successful growth since 1984 when we started out with $30 million. We believe the concept is performance at scale, and therefore we are constantly thinking about the intersection of achieving top tier. We always try for some version of top quartile performance as a trade-off for size. We are not public. We do not have anybody who gets paid for AUM, EPS. So we think about everything from the perspective of, is this a top returning investment and can a fund be too big to be able to achieve that? So we have managed our size in a different way. Obviously, our track records speak for themselves as the growth of the firm has demonstrated. More importantly, when you hear partners of our firm talk, we also talk about risk. We do think about generating real alpha, transformational change, and making sure that we are not just levering beta. Our performance has demonstrated itself through cycles, whether it's high multiples in private equity, whether it's low default rates in the credit businesses, hit rate in the life sciences businesses. We're constantly thinking about not just the return, but the risk, because through cycles, you need to have both of those things.
Private credit, as I mentioned earlier on, is not something we've talked a lot about on the Money Based podcast. And you're also within the firm CIO of the private credit business, Bain Capital Credit, which I think had a different genesis or a different name, at least at one stage. First of all, just explain how that private credit and why that private credit business came about.
In the mid-90s, as part of our strategy, we were looking at ways we could grow, not just by increasing the size of our private equity businesses, but what other assets would our investment approach apply to? We determined that early on, we had invested in private companies and had done well, so we started a public equity business. And then we said, we've done well with the equity of levered companies. You would think that that would translate into looking at other parts of the capital structure and moving up the capital structure and investing in the credit and the debt of those companies. When we start a new business at Bain Capital, we have a general philosophy that it's got to lever something we know how to do. It's got to be something that strengthens the whole, not just start something for the sake of starting it, but how does it fit in the integrated set of businesses we have. We've got to put our own money behind it. We won't do anything. We won't be the first investor in. And somebody senior at the firm either has to be willing to do it or put their name and reputation associated with it. Credit started at the time. It was unusual for a private equity firm to have a credit affiliate. Now it's very common, but back then we were the first or one of the first. So we did put a different name on it, Sankaty Advisors. I joke that I was selected to do it because I was a young partner, so I was senior enough to be credible and junior enough to be expendable if it didn't work.
That's right.
as it became more mainstream to have credit businesses, several years ago, we switched everything over and Brookside Capital became Bain Capital Public Equity and Credit, and our special situations business became Bain Capital, not Sankaty, but it's always been part of the firm. I would say that as we've developed the business, we've recognized, yes, that hypothesis was true, but to really do it well, which I believe we have, you need people who also specialize in the debt asset class. And as you grow any firm, as you grow regionally, our London office started with some folks from the United States, but it's all European citizens now. We don't have a bunch of Americans overseas running offices outside the United States. Figuring out how to merge the new skill and particular skill you might need to do something new with the historical skill of the firm and people who carry the culture is quite a challenge. And I think we've done that quite well.
I have an obvious skew towards the history of equity investing. And I think that we know equity investors and debt investors use different lenses, understandably. Tell us a little bit about how we should think about the risk reward as it plays out in your mind, because yours is all about getting paid back, isn't it?
Yes. One of the, on our par lending business, our private credit, our CLOs, our loans, our bonds, we very often lead with our loss rate. The fact that our private credit business has something like a 0.3% loss rate over our more than 20-year history. Equity investments don't start with their loss rate. They would always start with multiple. Secondly, we talk about the income yield. We talk about diversification, things that don't apply to traditional equity investing. That said, when you ask, how did you accomplish that? The language of how we looked at the industry, how we looked at the particular company, how we looked at the capital structure, those skills are very similar to what you'd see across the firm. It's the lens you overlay on that and what you do with that information. And there's plenty of times where I've said to somebody in an equity business, when they say bonds or loans look great, the sponsor's really happy with it. And I'm like, well, everything that makes the sponsor happy with this financing package is a reason why we won't buy it, because there are different interests. Of course, most of the time, those two things should be correlated, but not always. And then on the special situation side, that's a hybrid. Because in special situations, we do traditional distressed. Now you're recreating an enterprise at a certain level of the capital structure. Different than private equity or venture or any of our traditional private funds, where you're looking at the bottom of the capital and focused on the multiple. In distressed or special situations, you're creating the enterprise value at whatever level or price you invest. Therefore, in that business, sometimes it will look like a pure equity investment. You're buying a distressed company, you're converting bonds to equity at a particular valuation, but you've picked that valuation. There's other times where private equity will have turned something down because they don't think there's enough multiple in it. We will be brought in and work with the owners of the company to put some sort of structured solution in where we are willing to give up some upside to protect the downside. When you look at the analysis you do to do that, it's very similar analysis with a different lens depending on the fund it's going in.
Pausing on special situations, I'm interested because it almost by its name, it's difficult to plan for. And so spontaneity requires a reaction. Does that mean you draw people from the various camps to get onto whatever is happening? How do you plan for that? Or how do you react to it?
One of the strengths of our firm, and I probably should have highlighted this in what differentiates us, is John Connaughton, my co-managing partner, and I would simply describe our jobs as making sure that we deliver the whole platform of Bain Capital to our investors and to each other. Whether or not we're investing in the same thing, which happens sometimes, or we just need different skills, the ability in a given situation to reach to product specialists or to marketing specialists or to company specialists anywhere across the firm helps us fortify the core of each of our businesses. The special situations part of our business obviously is the biggest beneficiary of that because, as you correctly state, in any given market cycle, we don't know what's coming our way. But we have collaborated with private equity, Virgin Australia Airlines, where that was both distressed debt and recreating a company, and private equity and special sits did that together. there's been situations where we had the top tier of a venture-backed company that during the pandemic needed capital to get through because they were associated with technology around live events, and getting insights from our venture team on how the venture capitalists might think about that and what types of structures would be useful. That was incredibly helpful. I have stories like that, both geographically, industry-wise, and capital structure-wise, across our firm, dozens of stories a month where there's those types of collaborations taking place in all our business units. Special situations itself, we ourselves describe it where there's periods where special situations may look more debt-oriented than benign markets and hot equity markets. And then there's times like the last few years where it will look more equity oriented, where you're doing much more junior, much more higher returning things. And there's a cycle and a cadence to that.
So the thing I really love about these conversations is that suddenly somebody says something and it piques one's interest. I'd read something the other day about during the pandemic, 40 airlines in Europe had gone bust. Virgin Australia, just tell us, what was the story?
It's the second largest airline in Australia. It is largely a domestic carrier, although they had some international flights. They had been hurt particularly hard. They were less financially stable than Qantas and could not hold on during the pandemic. They were completely shut down. They had quite a bit of leverage on them. They filed for protection. A liquidation was a very possible outcome, which would have been horrible for Australia, for the employees, for competition in the Australian market. This is an example of our global footprint where we're in 20 cities throughout the globe, where we have two offices in Australia, and our Australian offices were still up and running while we were in lockdown. We dug in deeply. We had teams from our Australian private equity and special sits team, our Asian team. We have an expert in the United States on the lending side, on aircraft leasing and on airlines. We had a brand person. The last investment committee for this investment had 54 people from four continents on it, both listening and contributing, because we had been able to, in the pandemic, using Zoom, using technology, pull together the absolute best of the firm and particular skills for each part of this incredibly complicated situation, including identifying an airline executive who was able to work with us, and she is now the CEO of the company, and pull it all together and obviously make a credible bid, which has restarted the airline. And we're very proud thus far, it's early innings, of what we've accomplished.
Warren Buffett said he's always wanted to stay away from airlines, but just tell me, what does it look like in terms of what do you end up owning, debt and equity?
No, in this instance, all the debt was converted to equity. And in this instance, we put money in, reached an agreement with the creditors, and we own the equity of the airline. The difference between Warren Buffett buying public stock at a price and what we did here is we bought in at a particular valuation. Creditors took a haircut, and we were able to reject some leases on planes and have an optimized air fleet, optimized route maps, optimized schedule. So it's very different than going and buying the equity of a publicly traded airline.
Point taken. I was really intrigued when I read some of your writings about this distinction between pricing risk in relation to understanding uncertainty.
We have two jobs as investors. One is to price risk, and two is to understand the market environment in which we're investing. Sometimes there's things there that are uncertain that you cannot actually price. You can only bound. You can get the contours of what could happen, but it's really hard to put a point estimate in. And this builds off of something I read a long time ago by an MIT economist from the 20s called Knightian Uncertainty. He talks about how people need to understand which task they're doing. Because if you think you can price uncertainty, you're actually just guessing. Managing risk is something that is incumbent upon all investors. And therefore, if you think about some of the investments we made during the pandemic, we had no illusion that we could predict when the pandemic was going to be over. That was the uncertainty. That was the big overlay. I remember sitting in a meeting wondering whether or not we'd be back by the 4th of July or Labor Day in the United States. that was in April of 2020. So clearly the uncertainty of when we were going to go back to the office, we were right. It was going to be a Labor Day. We just had the wrong one. You could price the risk of how much money is a particular company going to burn each month and each quarter. And if we recognize that the risk is this could go on for years, which we did, the risk we're mitigating is cash burn and how much cash would we have to make sure we fortified our investments with, whether it was on the equity side or companies we were loaning money to, and making sure that we married those two and making sure that we understood there were things we should be spending an enormous amount of time understanding and getting a point estimate on. What were the risks we faced? There was things that we should be working on bounding, and that was the uncertainties around how long this could last, competitor reactions, government reaction, and that we had to watch and adapt our investment outlook as the facts on the field changed.
Well, I hope you're enjoying this episode so far. We've got lots more to come, but a quick word on our new sponsor. Last year, I interviewed Gary Boom, CEO of Bordeaux Index. Wine is a great love of mine, and as he explained, Bordeaux Index has become a major disruptor in the way that wine is bought and sold, and has sought to redefine the way a wine merchant works. I've been really impressed with their business, and have been buying wine from them since that interview. So we're delighted that the Money Maze podcast is now also sponsored by LiveTrade, their world-leading fine wine trading platform. LiveTrade has changed the way fine wine is bought and sold worldwide. You can instantly buy and sell or place bids and offers on key wines from Bordeaux, Champagne, Italy, and other world regions. Their two-way pricing offers guaranteed trading liquidity with no fees. So I recommend you have a look at their website, bordeauxindex.com/LiveTrade. The Money Maze podcast is also brought to you by our final sponsor, Mintos. The world of art investing has been typically out of reach for most investors, and yet returns have been very impressive. Mintos is a new concept in art investing, giving investors the chance to own the unownable through an FCA-authorized and regulated fractionalization platform, which offers access to iconic and rare paintings from contemporary art masters like Warhol, Kondo, Francis Bacon, and Basquiat. Actual paintings, not digital assets. For investors seeking to diversify their portfolios through an asset class historically uncorrelated with stock market investing and with strong returns, we've been impressed with Mintos and think it merits a closer look. The second piece that I read, which had me thinking that I don't necessarily agree with you, but I'm going to give you the chance to explain why I'm wrong, is you said investing is not the prediction business. And my feeling was in equity, you get a lot of mean reversion. You have to weigh up. The numbers tell you so much, but not everything. Can the new CEO manage the transition? Will the future look much like the past? Embodied within the equity decision-making process is a set of predictions that you need to add. So it's the qualitative meeting the quantitative. So why is investing not partly a prediction business?
That quote is in the context of predicting the direction of markets, predicting interest rates, the economy. If you could predict interest rates with any sort of actual accuracy, you should not do anything else and just go lever the most liquid market in the world. What our job is to do is, once again, is to analyze, and we can predict the returns of companies, but then you have to put that in the context of what markets are doing. Because at the end of the day, you can get the earnings of a company right, but have the valuation context in which you're going to either get paid back or sell the business wrong. The difference between predicting and adapting, as I was saying, is there's a whole new market reality on multiples right now. And if you had tried to predict what was going to happen 2 years ago, you would have gotten killed. It's down now, but even when you look at subprime mortgages, there are people who lost billions of dollars predicting that turn before they were actually right. So you need to recognize what your controllable and your analyzable variables are. And then what are the variables that you have a point of view on that you have to adapt to when the realities change? Eisenhower used to say, it's not the plans that matter, it's the planning that matters. And that is what I was trying to express there.
So I'm clear with what you said, and I'd like to just take it to the here and now. I'm just going to quote you or a comment from Vantage Investment Management's most recent report, and I know them very well because that's where I worked for a long time, talking about the US stock market today, and that will lead us on to talk about the current environment. Price to revenues is perhaps the most stable, normalizing rating for equity markets. There can be some drift over time, but the US's equity market price to revenues today is just over 2.5 times. It's still 10% higher than at the peak of the 2000 dot-com boom, and the US equity market needs to fall by around 35 to 40% from current levels just to trade at its median price to revenue rating of 1.4 over the next couple of years. That would be a prediction, but it would be based on historical mean reversion. And as you alluded to earlier on with your literary comments and looking at data, there is a rhyme and a rhythm, and it would not surprise many of us who are very bearish on the US that that happens. How are you thinking about your businesses in a climate faced with all of these macro fragilities and possibly a real change in the valuation level of public markets, which must feed into private markets?
First of all, I don't disagree with things look expensive. Mean regression is an actual thing. The adaption part of what I talk about is, as we look at those things now, what's different now? Well, one, there's much more access to capital for these private, particularly dot-com companies. Two, there are more established markets where you can analyze how long it takes to grow into your capital structure, right? You can overpay for something, which we try not to do, but in the current valuation market, it looks like a lot of things were overpaid for during the last year by a lot of people. That doesn't mean that they're all going to go back. That means it might take longer to achieve what you want. This is what I talked about earlier, that you may be able to achieve the same multiple of money. It may take an extra year or two, which will be an okay IRR, but not a good IRR. Versus, there's a lot of companies that are trading at multiples of revenues who have no actual chance of growing into their revenue base, whether it's a product that doesn't actually scale, whether it's things that have artificially high revenues because of the pandemic. One of the things that I've talked about in the past is nobody has a great feel for what normalized earnings are, and there are some prominent pandemic winners that are now getting killed. And we all need to figure out what the normalized level of their revenues are, their earning could be, their cash flow burn, and where they could access capital. And that's the adapting side of investing. The difficult thing to predict is, will it ever get to 1.4? Medians and averages do lie a little bit. The outliers, there's sector specific. Is there a difference between consumer brands and business to business brands? Is there a difference between subscription technologies versus one-time use technologies? Whenever you look at markets like this, you need to go below the surface and you need to do the company and the industry and the segmentation analysis, because out of things like this, on average, everything goes down. When everything goes down, people start throwing everything off the boat. There's a chart I saw of a bunch of revenue-based companies, very hot ones, I won't call out any in particular, that all had raced up and had different valuations. And then as they all sold off, they basically all sold off 50 or 90%. They had it by cohort. And in there, there must be winners and losers. And that is where good analysis, deep teams, business planning, patient capital, and thoughtful use of leverage or not using leverage makes a huge difference. And I would overlay that there's got to be an interconnection between interest rates and multiples. And I don't think anyone has a good understanding of what that looks like, because under normal circumstances, rates went down, everyone paid more. That made a lot of sense. Rates are going up. You would think multiples would come down, but there is a lot of money in the system. And we've seen this in distressed debt in 2020, that companies' prices never dropped as much as you might have expected them to on the debt side, because they were able to access capital to ride out the storm. And the question is, what does this storm look like? And who are the winners and who are the losers going to be? And who's going to be able to get capital?
You make the case for the defense very well. I take that. I was reading some other material, so I'm just going to quote it. You don't need to answer it, but it is interesting. When US inflation last surged to over 10% in 1979, the PE on the US equity market fell to under 10 times. It's always worth understanding potential parameters. Now, Having said exactly what I've said, I'm now going to sound like I am either being inconsistent, but I'm not. The US market may be expensive, but there are a lot of other markets that are not. And I'm looking right now at a market that nobody cares about, which is the UK equity market. A lot of private equity interest has been developing. It's been fair, and it might even be your quotation, which is that public markets have not been very kind to all sorts of investors. So when you've got either a sector or a geographic opportunity, I say that because the UK's case has had pension fund outflows forever, Brexit's accelerated it. How do you think about that? How do you move resources, calibrate the opportunity?
One of the strengths of our firm is we don't have to move resources. They're already there. We have a footprint of offices in 20 cities across the globe. One of the things about our firm is, although we're based in Boston, we do not describe our offices that are not in the United States as overseas, because if you live in the UK, you're not overseas, you're home. We do business locally, and we have both global funds and local funds. As you talk about the UK, we have 150 people between our private equity and our special situations and credit businesses who have been in London now for a very long time, almost, as I said, exclusively British and European professionals who live those markets, who are segmenting opportunities right now. One of the beauties we have is they will bring that to buy business unit, but some form of global investment committee, which will also have a perspective, and they themselves will have a perspective on what folks in our Mumbai office are doing and what they think is interesting, or the people in Melbourne, or Shanghai, or Hong Kong, or San Francisco. Our system is such that we are able to prosecute opportunities locally, but also in the context of looking at everything versus everything else. We have structured the firm in such a way that every business has a big enough local fund that they can prosecute most of their opportunities. But if they need more capital, we have global funds across the firm that can go alongside those investments. And that's true in private equity, that's true in technology, that's true in real estate, that's true in special situations in credit. Context really matters. The UK and the US markets are very close cousins, but having the local presence there makes a big difference. It makes also a huge difference in Tokyo and in Hong Kong, in markets and market contexts and interest rate environments that will look very, very different than what we're seeing today. We have a business model which is tracking opportunities all the time, even if we don't invest in them. And we may now be looking at things because valuations are tougher. They may not be able to get public. They may have trouble. They may have a bond maturity coming up. They may not want to take equity, but take something structured. That opportunities we've been tracking for 3 years, we may be working on now.
That's a very clear explanation. Makes me think, as the co-managing partner, how would you like Bain Capital to look 10 years on?
The most important thing is we continue to have great performance. We've attracted and kept the best people. We are even more a reflection of the communities in which we do business, and we've committed to DEI in every single one of our areas. On the investment side and how we manage the firm, I continue to like to see this unique, and I'm sorry I used the word unique, this cross-business collaboration that has taken hold in the last 5 years, where we've created something particular to our firm. Zoom actually accelerated that. I now have people who hop on a Zoom with somebody in Mumbai or in Melbourne easier than I used to be able to get them to walk from the 37th floor to the 38th floor of our building. It's like, oh my God, I got to go up there to go talk to somebody in another business unit. This concept that we are all one team and that we should try to find as many ways as possible to pull the knowledge of the firm together, to prosecute opportunities as best we can with the variety of capital that we have, I think has strengthened our firm over the last few years in a way that is unusual because of our private partnership structure.
It's a question that I had written down here. I'd written partnership matters as I listened to you. And some of your competitors have decided to list. Why are you an advocate for being a partnership?
One, it's worked for us. We recognize there's lots of ways to be successful. We have always thought that we have a stewardship model The only reason we would list is if we felt our investors, our limited partners, were at a disadvantage because we either didn't have access to particular kinds of deals or capital. And that just hasn't been the case. We think it's been a strength in attracting people and perpetuating the culture of the firm. And we just haven't seen a reason to do it. We didn't have a singular shareholder that we needed to sell down or anything like that. It works for our investors. We demonstrate that there's a lot of different ways to be successful. And undoubtedly, there has been some extraordinary success stories in the public markets. But at the moment, we don't see how that would make our firm better.
I just done a podcast with Michael Lewis of Liar's Poker. He, of course, had that ending conversation, I think it was in Vanity Fair, with John Gutfreund about Salomon Brothers. And he said, John, it all went wrong, didn't it, when you stopped being a partnership? ... I don't think his statement was answered. Bain Capital's had a very noticeable social justice and racial equity commitment. I think you've been doing this for some time. Just tell me, what does that mean?
It is incredibly important to us that we do the right thing, even when no one's looking, is an expression I use. We live our values. We are contributing to the good of all the communities in which we are involved, and we define community very broadly, and that we recognize that anybody in a seat at Bain Capital or any peer firm has been extraordinarily lucky. There have been breaks in our lives. We may all think we're the smartest and we got great grades and all that. But I went to a public high school in downtown Providence, Rhode Island, and never questioned whether or not I would be able to accomplish anything I want. And I know there are other kids who were in public high schools in other cities across the United States who just never got that one break. And as an institution, uniformly at all levels of the institution, we really do try to think about how we can have lasting impact with a creativity and a tenacity that we do with our companies. You need to define stakeholder more broadly. And if people who have achieved the fortunes and life and the success that we have don't engage to try to level the playing field and correct injustices that clearly exist, then who is going to do it? And it's just in our ethos. And this is not a new thing for us. CityEar is the largest national service not-for-profit in the United States. It was the basis for AmeriCorps. People at Bain Capital have been involved with CityEar since 1991. Their mission is to go into public schools in the United States. They're also in London and Northern England and South Africa and Johannesburg, and try to be near peer mentors to help encourage students to get through school, to graduate, because studies show that dropping out of high school is one of the leading predictors of difficult outcomes in life, in health, in income, so many things. And if you can keep kids in school and on track, that is one of the big legs up that somebody can get. And there's a whole series of things we've been doing since more than 30 years ago. But we think now, particularly in the wake of what's happened in the United States recently, particularly with George Floyd, that we need to make our voice louder, that we need to tell our own people that we are behind positive change, that we are calling out the problems, and we are vowing to participate in the solutions.
So a few closing questions. You just mentioned students and young people. How would you, when you were approached by young people saying and thinking about private investing and a career in finance, what advice do you offer?
I tell people that they should know why they want to do it. And I know that sounds obvious, but if you chase a job or a career that you might not be good at just because it pays well, chances are you're not going to be successful at it. You need to decide that you have both an aptitude and an interest in the work. Secondly, I tell people, do not become monofocused on the job, and that you need to step out of yourself. You need to both take care of yourself through fitness and making sure that you don't burn yourself out, but also engage in your community, because you will feel better about yourself. You will appreciate the power of the platform that you work at. If you can not just make money for yourself, but do positive good, there is all sorts of work that's been done that shows that people who engage in any sort of philanthropy or volunteerism are happier, are more successful at work, are more engaged in life. Lastly, ours is not an industry where you master it in 9 months and you bounce to the next thing. as you consider career changes, you should know you should never run from something. You should go to something else. When I went from McKinsey to Bain Capital, there were very particular things that I saw in Bain Capital that were really attractive to me. And I had a vision of what I could do with that firm and who that firm was. I did not leave McKinsey because I didn't like consulting. I actually like consulting very much. Always be purposeful in the decisions you're making. Default decisions rarely are good ones.
What would be the one book you would recommend?
There is no possible way I could recommend one book. What book that touches you at any moment in time has a lot to do with what that moment in time is. And therefore, I've talked about a book by a woman named Sarah Hurwitz called Here All Along. She was Michelle Obama's speechwriter. And after she left the White House, she actually wrote a book on faith. She rediscovered her Judaism. It is specifically about Judaism, but it is more an exploration of faith from the perspective of somebody who is a communicator, language, and the difference between ritual and belief, and the difference between how you act and what oral histories, medieval, that do not actually pertain to the foundations of the religion. She has a brilliant chapter in there on God and how people think about God, and can you be a person of faith and not believe in God? And she said, I have no idea what God is, but I'm pretty sure it's not an old man sitting in a chair. Another book that really impacted me, and particularly at this moment in time, is Bryan Stevenson's Just Mercy, which explores somebody who had been sentenced to death and put on death row in the United States in a race-based sentencing. Bryan took on the case and chased it for a decade to get this man off, which he ultimately did, and he was exonerated. But it opened my eyes to some of the incredible injustices in the United States that are getting reported on now, but have been going on for a long time. That book I read back in 2015, 2016, I actually sought Bryan out. I figured out we had a common friend, the person who gave me the book, and I asked to meet Bryan and how my wife and I could support his work. It's called the Equal Justice Initiative. Some of the racial equity and social justice work that my wife and I do, and some of what contributes into what the firm does, and a number of people at the firm have gotten to know him, has been inspired by knowing Bryan and knowing some other great social entrepreneurs. I think that everybody should also always read some form of fiction, some storytelling, an exploration of the human mind. And fiction is so personal. One of my favorite books is A Tale of Two Cities. I also love a more recent popular author, Frederick Bachman, who wrote Bear Town, Anxious People, and A Man Called Uwe, which explores the way people deal with different kinds of setbacks. To what I said earlier, people need to step back from themselves, and people need to read or watch documentaries or do something to engage in other than just business.
I am going to say, I don't think I've ever talked about a book on this podcast, but I just finished, I thought it was a beautifully written book called A Gentleman in Moscow. It's actually been a New York Times bestseller, maybe a couple of years old. I'm probably late to it. Everybody's going, Simon, get with the program. But Gentleman in Moscow, I just thought it was absolutely delightfully written. My final question to you, Jonathan, is if you could tell us just one thing, the most important piece of advice you would impart.
It's never as good as it looks or as bad as it feels. And finding that balance is really, really important. Back in college and in high school, I played competitive golf. And there's a saying in golf, the most important shot is the next one, because you can't replay the last shot ever. I wish my 20-year-old self knew that. But seriously, those are the two things which are different sides of the same coin.
God, I wish my 58-year-old self knew that as well. But anyway, tomorrow will be another day. We're going to end it here because you've been very generous with your time and you have given a very clear and a very helpful explanation of Bain Capital and its approach. I write down one or two things. The problem today is I have written down seven. I'm just going to say a couple of things as a summary. You have summarized your business. I think you've explained this really important concept of pricing risk in relation to understanding uncertainty very clearly. We'll have a better feel for the breadth and diversity of the Bain Capital business and of the credit world, but more generally, the advice which, and we hope at some stage to write a book on the Money Maze podcast of some of the great advice and counsel that's been offered. But I like the fact you said, don't be monofocused on the job. You also said, don't run from, go to. And now I've just scribbled down, never as good as it looks or as bad as it seems. So there you go. You have proved to be a literary and other oracle. Jonathan, thank you so much for being a guest on the Money Maze podcast today.
It's been an honor and a pleasure to join you on the Money Maze podcast. I've listened for a long time and was delighted when you asked me to join you.
Oh, you're very gracious. Thank you so much. Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.